The reapers quarrelled it out amongst themselves and finally settled that Chalcedony and Gladius should come, and Cantarella should take charge of the rest staying behind and have an epaulet. Monsey got one for command of the couriers. It was nearly as large as his head, but pleased him very well. And Minnow also. So there was no quarrelling or ill-feeling at all in the end, which Temeraire felt a credit to his arrangements.
"We are a very handsome company, are we not?"
Temeraire asked Lawrence, hoping to find him satisfied.
"It is a pity about Ischierka, but no one could quarrel with our choices otherwise, I'm sure."
"Yes," Lawrence said.
"I have only been thinking," Temeraire said, with a sidelong look. He hoped it would not seem selfish. "That it would be just as well if we got back the rest of our crew. Not that we are not perfectly comfortable as we are," he added. "But a few more bellmen to manage some bombs, and it might be convenient to have Winston back to help fellows."
"Those who wished to return have done so," Lawrence said. "I cannot require any man to serve with a traitor."
"Oh," Temeraire said, "but—"
and stopped. It had not occurred to him that the crew had chosen not to come back, that they had rather be elsewhere, on another dragon and with another captain. It seemed very strange to him when he was now a commodore, and must surely have been more impressive, if anything. He wondered if perhaps Lawrence was mistaken, or only shy of asking for them. Perhaps they did not even know that he and Lawrence were free.
"But surely Martin, at least, or Ferris would come," he said.
Lawrence was very still a moment, and then he said,
"Ferris has been dismissed the service."
Only because, it seemed, the admirals imagined that Ferris had been of some help, even though he had done nothing at all.
"But then where is he?" Temeraire asked.
If Ferris were not with some other dragon, it stood to reason he would rather be with them. But Lawrence said with finality,
"Any communication from me must be wholly unwelcome."
Temeraire did not press him further, but privately he thought that perhaps he would write to Ferris, if he could get Emily or Sifo, perhaps, to take down a letter for him, and find out Ferris's direction. And then a dragon he knew a little from Dover, or Kestia, landed in the courtyard. She was back from patrol, and his own midwingman, Martin, was with her crew, his bright yellow hair standing out against his green coat.
"Mr. Martin,"
Temeraire called out, seeing him go by, thinking perhaps to ask him over, and see if he knew that Temeraire had been made commodore, and whether he was quite sure he would not prefer to go with them on their own particular mission. Martin started a little at being named, and looked over, but then he turned his back and walked on into the citadel with the rest of the Orchestia's crew. Not even a word, or a gesture. And he had always been so very friendly.
"Temeraire," Lawrence said, "you will oblige me very greatly if you will make no such gesture again."
"No, I will not," Temeraire said, much subdued.
It was not only that Martin had ignored them. He had done it so very openly, as though he wanted everyone else to know he meant to do it. There was something particularly unpleasant to it. Anyone might not feel like conversation, of course, but this was showing away how little he wanted it with them in particular.
"But," Temeraire said to Lawrence slowly, "does that mean he does not approve, that we took over the cure? Surely he would not have wished to see all those dragons dead."
"Between two evils he might have found that the lesser than treason,"
Lawrence said, without lifting his head from the book which he was reading.
"Oh, then I am not sorry,"
Temeraire said defiantly.
"He may stay with Orchestia, for all I care, if she wants him."
He felt rather wounded, though, for all his bravado, and he had not yet understood the worst. He did not realize the implication of what they had done to poor Ferris until that very afternoon. All of them assembled and ready to fly, his harness rigged out and his epaulets bright in the thin, wintry sunshine, and a runner had come to let them know they might go to Edinburgh. And he said,
"Mr. Lawrence, your orders, sir, from the Admiral," handing him the packet.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said, and did not correct the boy. He only took the papers and put them in his coat pocket, and for the first time Temeraire realized, looking closely, that Lawrence was not wearing the gold bars upon his shoulders which the other captains wore. Temeraire did not want to ask. He did not want to hear the answer. But he could not help it.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said.
"I have been struck the service too. It does not matter now," he added after a moment, "when of course it mattered, as much as anything. We must away."
Lawrence stood by the parapet, looking out to sea, in the upper court of Edinburgh Castle. Temeraire lay somewhere in the dark covert below the castle, a great yawning darkness in the side of the illuminated city which stretched out around the castle and down to the River Forth. Ships rose and fell uneasily on the water, and the wind blew sharp needles of frozen rain into his face. In the far distance he could see a handful of lights moving, too high for ships, too bright for stars, a few dragons on patrol.
"Another 300,000 of them buggers lying along the coast from Calais to Boulogne, just waiting for their chance," a sergeant of marines said to his fellow soldier as the two of them came by on their round, and he spat aggressively over the parapet towards the sea, as if he might hit the distant enemy. They had not yet seen Lawrence. Wellesley and his staff were inside the tower chambers. He had been left outside until called for, despite the night cold and wet, the stones slick with ice, and room enough in the antechamber for him to wait inside. A deliberate slight. The damp penetrated his cloak and his leather coat effortlessly, but he had chosen to stand at the limit of the parapet, out of the lantern light, so he could see farther out. It was only a romantic impulse. He could not see anything of real significance at this hour.
"He'll squeeze over another 1,000 tonight," the sergeant went on. "Every dark night those fucking fleur-de-nuis carry them. The Navy shot one down 2 days ago, though," he added with vindictive satisfaction. "Down into the ocean like a stone, and 200 frogs on its back, I hear. But more often than not they can't be seen."
"I heard as he burned Weedon to the ground," the young soldier with him ventured. "I heard he set dragons on it, sent the whole place up."
"Fucking Jacobin buggers," the sergeant said gloomily.
"Begging your pardon, sir," he said,
seeing Lawrence and touching his hat. He nodded to them, and they fell silent, taking their post. A door opened in the side of the tower, and raised voices came drifting out, while its side gently shut again. More heated argument, strategy, and sacrifice. Lawrence looked, but it was not Wellesley or one of his aides. It was an old man in nightshirt and bed-slippers, muttering to himself as he came into the rain. His hair was grey and thinned out, matted without a wig, and he walked with the uneasy hitch of rheumatism as he groped his way towards the chapel across the courtyard.
"Is it the vicar?" the young marine whispered.
"At this hour?" the sergeant said doubtfully,
and they both looked at Lawrence. Lawrence crossed the courtyard to go to his side. The old man did not seem steady on the wet, icy stones, and he was talking to himself, a stream of low, unintelligible speech, which remained incomprehensible even as Lawrence came close enough to make out the words.
"Horses," the old man said. "Horses and mules, and 3 weeks' grain, and Copenhagen, the fleet in Copenhagen, £33.
He did not seem to notice Lawrence's approach at all, until Lawrence said,
"Sir, should you not go back inside?"
"I will not," the old man said, querulous. "Is that you, Murat? Is that you?"
He peered at Lawrence's face, touched his coat, and, evidently satisfied, nodded.
"You are not Napoleon. You are Murat. Are you here to kill me? Give me your arm,"
he said, abruptly peremptory, and taking a grip on Lawrence's arm, leaned on him heavily. He had fixed his gaze on the chapel and started determinedly to limp on towards it.
"They all mean to kill me,"
he told Lawrence confidentially.
"They are in there, talking of it now. My son is with them."
He sounded neither indignant nor afraid, more as though he were sharing a piece of interesting gossip. Lawrence looked back at the tower, and then at the old man again, at his profile, and recognition came.
"Sire," Lawrence said, low and wretchedly, "may I not help you inside? You ought not be out in this weather."
He dragged at the ties of his own cloak, and shrugging it off, managed to put it over the king's shoulders.
"I will go to Windsor," the king said. "Napoleon is not there. Why may I not go to Windsor?"
He continued his unsteady progress towards the chapel, and Lawrence had either to pace him or let him go alone.
"He is in London. He is in London. He is not in Windsor. I need not go to Halifax. It will be cowardly to go. Do you want me to go to Halifax?"
he demanded.
"My son wants me to go. He wishes me to die on the ocean."
"I would wish to see you safe, sire," Lawrence said, "as I am sure would he."
"I will not go,"
the king said.
"I ought not go. I will die in England."
The door flung open again. Frightened servants, hurrying with cloak and umbrella to hold over him and coax him back within. They gave Lawrence no more than a glance, and he stepped back to let them work. The king's voice rose in protest over their guiding hands, and then died away again into muttering confusion. He let himself be drawn gradually back inside.
"Poor old fella,"
the sergeant of marines said, coming close to peer after them for a glimpse inside the tower.
"Gone out of his head, I suppose. Who was he?"
Lawrence stood in the courtyard, behind the closing door, rain running down his sleeves and his face like blood. Stood and said aloud,
"Oh God, I wish I had not done it."
Chapter 13. Temeraire pulled close around himself, his tail coiled snugly against his body, and tried without much success to sleep. There were a great many things he did not want to think about, but so long as he continued awake, they clamoured for his attention. They had landed in Edinburgh Covert only after dark, and found it wet and bleak and muddy, and the water of the pond not fit to drink. There were too many dragons buried there too recently. So they had to take turns putting their heads below a thin runoff from the castle walls, which tasted unpleasantly green, and settle themselves uncomfortably between two burial mounds most widely separated. They were crowded, and there was plenty of room for one or another of them to go and sleep among the other mounds, but no one at all proposed to go off alone. They rather huddled more closely. Lawrence had left almost at once to go and speak with Wellesley, and he was gone a long time, enough that they had finished their dinner long before his return. A couple of old tough cows and three sheep, hacked up and pit-roasted with a great heap of potatoes which Gong Su had organised the crews to procure. Happily, these took on some of the flavour of the meat and were not unappetising at all once they had cooked long enough.
"I don't hold with this cookery much,"
Maximus had said, licking his chops, having slowly and thoughtfully wrecked 17 bushels of potatoes roasted in their skins.
"But these are not half bad, if one cannot have a nice fresh cow, that is."
Temeraire took a long time over his own meal, but at last he had stretched it as far as it could go, and Maximus was eyeing the last pile of sheep intestines hopefully, so Temeraire had to finish it off. And then he had nothing to do but lie uncomfortably in the mud, curled up, small, to stay warmer, and worry about Lawrence.
"Of course he ain't happy,"
Gentius said sleepily.
"The country overrun by all these frogs. Who would be happy? I would not think much of his sense if he were dancing a jig."
"But that is not the same as unhappy," Temeraire said, "when we are going to fight to make the French leave, and will have some battles soon."
Gentius cocked his head ruminatively.
"Men like to be unhappy sometimes," he offered. "My second captain would come sit under my wing with a book, and weep over it most evenings. I thought at first she must be wounded, but she told me not to fret at all. She liked to do it, and the next morning she would be right as rain again."
Temeraire was doubtful. He had never noticed Lawrence weeping over a book, although sometimes he did not enjoy them very much. But he did not quite like to press the conversation very far. To be perfectly honest, Temeraire was a little concerned. He was perhaps anxious. Very well, he was afraid that he might learn that Lawrence was not so much upset as angry. He was afraid that Lawrence was angry with him. Temeraire had not quite understood what it would mean for Lawrence to be called a traitor. Of course, the government meant to execute him or imprison them away from one another, but Temeraire had thought, with those two fates averted, that otherwise all would be much the same. And at first it seemed so. They flew together, and were given orders, and everything nearly like, but it was not the same at all. Of course, there had been no other alternative but to take over the cure, only Temeraire had not quite understood
before they went, that treason meant Lawrence should be losing his life, and his crew, and his rank.
"At least," he said, "at least you are still my captain. And after all, while there are many captains who have some sort of dragon, I am the only dragon who is a commodore."
But when he had tried this argument out privately to himself, it did not sound really consoling after all. Puffing himself off as though Lawrence ought to be satisfied with Temeraire's consequence and none of his own, insult to injury, and Lawrence had lost his gold bars too. Temeraire raised his head out of the mud and said,
"Roland, do you know Captain Fenter's neck chain, the gold one with the emerald? It is not official, is it? Anyone might wear something of the sort."
It was a handsome piece which he and all the others at Loch Laggan had remarked on the captain of a smug angle-wing named Orchestia, and Temeraire thought something very suitable to the captain of a dragon of elevated rank, however neglectful of him the corps might be.
"Do you suppose that Lawrence might buy something like it here in town?"
"I expect he could not afford it. The lawsuit, you know," she said wisely, looking up from her boots, which she was blacking.
"What lawsuit?" Temeraire said, puzzled.
"Over those slaves," she said, "which we let loose in Africa. Those slave owners we carried back sued the captain, and I suppose he could not fight the suit very well as he was in prison, so they've taken all his capital."
"Taken it?"
Temeraire with difficulty kept his tail from quivering and thumping upon the ground.
"Surely not all his capital," he said in a struggling voice.
"I heard it was £10,000 or something like," Emily said.
10,000 pounds!
Gentius exclaimed, horror-struck, his head jerking from the ground, the mud squelching dreadfully.
10,000 pounds! You did not say anything about 10,000 pounds gone. Why, that is 10 of those eagles or more!"
And everyone murmured, shocked. Even Maximus and Lily flinched, and could not quite look at Temeraire. Temeraire felt quite staggered and nearly ill. Lawrence had not said anything beforehand. He had not said that all his treasure should be taken away, or so Temeraire tried to argue to himself, but it felt a very flimsy and weak excuse, and when he opened his mouth to make it to the others, he stopped without giving it voice. He had not troubled to find out, and now here he was, himself a commodore, showing away with jewels and 2 epaulettes, while Lawrence had nothing but a plain coat growing every day more shabby.
10,000 pounds,
Gentius said again, censoriously, wagging his head from side to side.
You have certainly made a good mull of it.
And Temeraire huddled himself down, feeling all the justice of the condemnation.
But if we had not taken over the cure, he said, rather small, a great many dragons should have died, even who had nothing at all to do with the war or France. It cannot have been wrong.
If you ask me, Poseidia said after a moment, the French ought to have given you some treasure to make up for it, as you went on their account. At least, not precisely on their account, she amended, but they did well out of it, so I don't think much of them letting you come out the worse, sir, when you needn't have done it at all.
Well,
Temeraire said, and was forced to admit that such an offer had been made, and a most handsome one.
Only Lawrence said no, because that would have been more treasonous, he finished.
I don't see myself how getting treasure after you had already done treason could make it any worse,
Chalcedony said.
After all, they are the enemy, and if they gave you treasure, they would have less, and that would be worse for them. So, if you ask me, it would really have been making up for the treason to take it.
Which struck Temeraire as a very just point, and one he rather wished he had thought of at the time.
"Only I did not realise Lawrence would lose his capital," Temeraire said unhappily, "so I did not think it would be so important."
"Well, well, you are a young fellow yet," Gentius said, relenting a little, "and you have time to make it up. Win battles, take some prizes while you are at it, and it will all come right in the end. Government will do you upright if you are only heroic enough."
"But I have been very heroic," Temeraire protested, "and they have not been fair at all. They have even tried to take Lawrence away from me."
"You ain't been the right sort of heroic," Gentius said. "You must win battles, that is the road. That is how my first captain was made, you know. They did not used to let long-wing captains be captain properly. They called her only Miss, and there was a fellow aboard she was supposed to listen to. Only he was a lummox, and managed to be drunk out of his wits just when we had a battle to go to and all our formation waiting.
He snorted.
So she said to the crew, "Gentlemen."
And here he paused, rubbing his forelegs restlessly against one another with a frowning expression. They waited, and waited, and waited, although Temeraire was almost quivering with impatience. If Gentius's captain had gone from Miss to Captain, surely Lawrence might have his rank repaired in the same fashion.
"It is difficult to remember the way she said it, exact," Gentius said defensively. "They don't talk as they used to, but I think I have it. She said, 'Gentlemen, seeing that our duty consisteth in going to war, I should judge this a sad excuse to fail in it, in so far as we expect to contrive without Captain "Bother," Gentius muttered, interrupting himself. "I have forgot his name. But she said it," he went on, "and she said, 'In so far as we expect to contrive without his company, no worser an outcome upon the field than our absence will ensure, the which I will stand surety for, therefore will I still go, and any man who wisheth not to venture himself under my command may remain behind.'"
He rolled triumphantly through to the end of his recitation, but then had to wait for applause while his audience worked out just what had been said.
"But I don't understand. Did you win the battle or not?"
Masoria said finally, puzzled.
"Of course we won the battle," Gentius said irritably. "And we did a sight better without Captain Halding. Ha! I have remembered his name after all, aboard. I can tell you that. I was writ up in the newspapers, even, and government gave over and made her captain properly, because we had done well,"
he finished, with a meaningful nudge to Temeraire's shoulder.
"That is the road. Win battles for them, and they will come about, see if they don't."
"That is all very well," Ischiaca remarked, "as soon as they let us have some battles. There he comes now. Ask him when we shall be fighting."
And she nudged Temeraire. Lawrence was coming down the path from the castle. Temeraire hardly knew how to look Lawrence in the face. Bitterly conscious now of his guilt, he half expected Lawrence to upbraid him at once. But Lawrence said only to Roland and to Domain and Sifo,
"Go and rouse up the other captains, at once, if you please,"
and stood waiting and silent until the others had been drawn from their uncomfortable bivouacs.
"Gentlemen, I have been commissioned, temporarily, and given command of this expedition. You will find your written orders there, and I trust they allow of no ambiguity."
Lawrence had a sheaf of papers in his hands, packets each sealed separately and inscribed with the other captains' names. He handed the orders to Sifo to carry around.
"Damn the paperwork with Bonaparte in our parlour!"
Berkeley muttered.
"Trust the army for this sort of thing!"
"You will oblige me greatly, Berkeley, by putting those orders by safe. Somewhere they cannot come to harm,"
Lawrence said, when Berkeley would have crumpled the parchment.
"I will be glad to know the chain of command quite clear to anyone who should inquire in future."
All the other captains paused and looked at him, and Temeraire wondered, puzzled, why it should matter. The red wax seals affixed to the parchment were attractive, but they might be made any time one wished, and Lawrence had not kept one himself. But Lawrence did not explain further. Instead, he went on,
"The French are harassing our farmers with raiding bands, and so supplying the wants of their army. Our duty is to stop this predation, and so far as is practicable, without undue risk to the dragons, to reduce the forces available to Napoleon."
There was a pause, and then Granby said,
"You mean his irregulars?"
"I do,"
Lawrence said.
"What does he expect us to do with the prisoners? Cart them about with us in the belly rigging?"
Berkeley said.
"There will be no quarter given," Lawrence said.
There was a heavy finality to his tone, which somehow warned off any other questions. The captains did not say anything, even to one another.
"We will begin in Northumberland tomorrow and work our way south. We leave at dawn, gentlemen. That is all."
They stood a moment longer, looking at their orders and at Lawrence, with oddly uncertain expressions.
In the end they all drifted away back to their tents without another word said. Temeraire himself was at a standstill. He could not understand why Lawrence should have taken the command. He was already in command, and it was important, was it not, for a dragon to have the post. Lawrence himself had said as much. Temeraire did not mean to be selfish any more at all, now that he knew he had been selfish. If Lawrence wished the command, of course he should have it. And yet, if it mattered for politics, for all the dragons... He struggled over it, ventured at last timidly to ask, and added hurriedly, "I do not mind at all for myself personally. I am very happy that you are restored and a captain now again. Only, if it is important..." He was yet mostly coiled up with the others, but everyone else was asleep. The other men were gone into their tents. Lawrence had told Roland and Domain and Sifo to go and sleep in his tent, and had stayed out, wrapped in his coat and cloak, and looking over maps which he had laid out on a small camp table. He was marking them with a small wax pencil here and there.
"In the present case it is the more important you should not be in command, or anyone but myself," Lawrence said.
There was something odd in his voice, queerly flat, as if he did not much care what he was saying, and he did not look up from his work. Temeraire wished very much it were not so dark, and he could see Lawrence's face.
"In any case," Lawrence added, "whether the courts will believe you truly the commander is a proposition yet untried, and I hope you would not risk the lives and the careers of the other captains unconsenting for the sake of your precedence."
"But," Temeraire said, "are they not risking their lives anyway?"
"In battle," Lawrence said, "not afterwards."
Temeraire did not much want to pursue. However dreadful to think Lawrence was angry with him, it would be all the worse to know, to hear it from Lawrence himself.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said anyway, bravely, "pray explain to me. I know I have let you be hurt because I did not try to understand well enough, and I do not mean to let it happen again. Only I cannot help it if I do not know."
Lawrence did look up at that, his eyes briefly catching a reflection from the castle upon the hill.
"There is nothing to help. I am in no danger."
"If they should be, so should you," Temeraire said.
"I cannot be condemned twice," Lawrence said. "Pray get some rest. We have 100 miles to fly in the morning."
"I want him bled,"
Wellesley had said, in the tower room of Edinburgh Castle, standing over the map of England, swarming with blue markers, with the icy rain lashing at the windows. Distantly, down the hall, the muffled sound of the king's voice was rising in some complaint. To Lawrence it seemed very loud.
"Every man to him is worth 5 to us. He must bring them across at great expense, and he must spend his dragon's strength to do it. And his men live off the land. He relies upon them raiding the countryside, feeding themselves and driving in cattle for the dragons, and keeping his supply lines meagre and short."
"You mean you wish us to attack his irregulars?" Lawrence broke in, tired of evasions.
"His supply lines, his foragers, his scouts."
Wellesley thumped the map.
"He has hundreds of small raiding parties scattered throughout the country north of London. He cannot survive long without them, and they are exposed. You will destroy every one of them you can find. You will not engage," he added, "any substantial party with other dragons in number or artillery. I do not mean to lose any of the beasts."
Lawrence had expected something of the sort from the tenor of Wellesley's summons. He was not surprised, and heard it with dull acceptance. The strategy was sound, coldly speaking. If Bonaparte began to lose men quicker than he could replace them, and found his supply growing short, he would have to accept a battle on whatever terms it was offered him, or withdraw entirely. But dragons were not put to such a use in civilized warfare. Wellesley knew it, and so did he. Pragmatism alone held them too valuable to risk and too expensive to supply, save against a more substantial target of strategic importance than a small party of light foot armed only with muskets. But it was not pragmatism, but sentiment, which with a single voice called inhuman the exceptions made from time to time. There was little that aroused more horror and more condemnation from ordinary men than the prospect of dragons set loose against them. Men had been court-martialed and hanged for it, even by their own side.
"Pillaging," Wellesley added after a moment, "of course, cannot be tolerated."
"There will be none," Lawrence said, "save what must be requisitioned to feed the dragons. Is there anything else?"
Wellesley looked at him narrowly.
Will you do it?"
There was little enough Lawrence could now do to repair what he had done. He could not restore the lives of the slain, or raise up ships from the channel floor that had been sunk, or make recompense to all the ordinary countrymen whose livelihood and possessions had been raided away by an invading army. He could not repair his father's health, or the king's, or Edith's happiness. But he had already stained himself irrevocably with dishonour, for the sake of an enemy nation and a tyrant's greed. He could stain himself a little more for the sake of his own, and shield with his own ruined reputation those who yet had one to protect.
"I do not need written orders for myself," he had answered Wellesley, "but I require them for those other officers of the corps involved. You may say merely that they must follow my orders."
Wellesley had understood very well what Lawrence offered him, and he had not refused it. The orders were written and given him, and he had left Wellesley in his tower and gone down and down to the waiting covert. It was a silent, grim camp in the morning as they harnessed the dragons and the crews went aboard. Twice or more Lawrence thought Harcourt almost meant to speak to him, but in the end they all mounted up and flew, with no words exchanged. The cold wind in Lawrence's face was welcome, and the steady beat of Temeraire's wings, and the silence. His small crew did not address him, and sitting forward on Temeraire's neck, they might have been alone in a wide open sky. The rolling, unmarred moors beneath them knew nothing of war or boundaries. Wellesley's spies had reported already a dozen raiding bands or more moving through the North Country, stealing from farms and seizing cattle. Lawrence had marked them on his map as best the reports could place them, but the enemy provided them instead a convenient beacon of smoke, easily visible 10 miles off. It was a thin black coil turning lazily upwards from the roof of a great farmhouse, the fire mostly extinguished by the time they arrived. The rest of the village stood empty when the dragons came down, but for 2 men in homespun. Villagers, not soldiers, laid out in the road, dead, with stab wounds flower red upon their bellies. They had been bayoneted.
"The villagers shan't come out while we have the dragons here," Harcourt said. "If we leave them outside—"
"No,"
Lawrence said. He did not mean to waste time on such things. He cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"We are officers of the king! You will come out at once, or we will have the dragons tear down the houses until you do!"
There was no reply, no stirring.
"Temeraire,"
Lawrence said, and indicated a small, neat cottage near the end of the village lane.
"Bring it down, if you please."
Temeraire looked at it and said uncertainly,
"Shall I roar?"
"However you choose,"
Lawrence said.
"Ought I bring it all down at once?"
Temeraire asked, turning his head to inspect the cottage. He darted a look back at Lawrence, as if trying to gauge his real intent.
"Perhaps if I just took off this chimney."
"Oh, you are taking too long!"
Iskiaka said, and promptly blasted it with fire, the dry thatched roof going alight in a merrily crackling instant. It burned fiercely, putting out sharp smoke, the flames licking out eagerly towards its neighbours. Lawrence sat waiting, and after a moment a cellar door creaked open and a few men came forth.
"Put it out! For God's sake, put it out!"
one of them begged, gasping.
"All the village will catch!"
"Berkeley, if you'll be so good,"
Lawrence said. Maximus took off the burning roof, and laying it on the ground, scraped some dirt over it with a clumsy swipe, leaving it half buried. Lawrence looked back at the villagers, who stared up at him pale and sweating.
"Which way did the French go?"
"Towards Scarrow Hill,"
the older man said after a moment, his voice still trembling.
"With all our cattle, every last one."
The faint lowing of a cow from the woods made him a liar on that point, but Lawrence did not care.
"They left not an hour."
"Very good. To quarters, gentlemen, and let the riflemen make ready,"
Lawrence said over his shoulder to the other captains.
"Aloft, Temeraire. Along the road."
They caught the French 15 minutes later, and heard them first, singing a bawdy snatch of "Auprès de ma blonde qu'il fait bon, fait bon, fait bon," as they marched through a forested section. Then they emerged out onto the road again, cattle in a string bellowing and throwing their heads, uneasy as they scented the dragons aloft. The men pulled irritably on the cows' heads and tried to drag them along. They did not look up. Temeraire craned his head back and looked at Lawrence. 10 dragons came on behind them.
"Mr. Allen,"
Lawrence said,
"signal the attack."
Chapter 14.
"I do not see what is wrong with it," Iskierka said, still nibbling upon the charred beef bones of her dinner. "They are stealing the cows for their dragons. It is not our fault if their dragons are too lazy to come and get the cows themselves."
"It is not wrong," Temeraire said, dissatisfied. "Precisely."
"Not very sporting, though," Gentius said. "They did not even have a gun."
"The village did not have a gun either, or even muskets," Lily said, "so it was not very sporting of those soldiers in the first place. Anyway," Iskierka added, with an air of smug virtue, "we must obey our orders."
Temeraire did not argue further. It was not that he minded for himself, anyway, very much, although it had not been a very interesting battle. They had dived, the soldiers had fired a few shots, and then they had all run away into the woods, if they were not dead. It had lasted scarcely 5 minutes, and nothing to show for it, except, of course, the cows, but those they mostly had to give back. He was not going to say so, of course, but he rather felt Iskierko was right. If the soldiers had not wanted to be attacked, they ought not to have been going about in other people's territory, taking their food and much more than they could eat themselves. Only he was a little worried, because it seemed the sort of thing that Lawrence might have minded, and he felt instinctively there was something strange, that Lawrence did not seem to care. The villagers certainly had been very grateful.
2 months to spring! We would have starved or near enough! Thank you, sir, the villager headman said, the half-burned cottage quite forgiven, as the others came nervously out to look over their cattle and their goods, and make their own anxious courtesies.
A few young men from Maximus's ground crew had driven back those cows which had not been killed or panicked to death in the fighting. Gladius and Chalcedony had carried back the 2 large carts of grain also, and the villagers had sent word back along the road to those others pillaged to come and share what there was left to have. But Lawrence did not seem pleased by their many thanks either. He only nodded and said,
"Send word also that if you should see or hear of any French movements, you are to light a beacon, smoke or a bonfire at night, and we will come for it if we see."
Gong Su had taken those cows which had been killed, enough for all the dragons to have a little fresh roast beef, and then a share of soup and bones and meat, mixed with vegetables and grain, for all the crew and everyone in the village besides. The atmosphere was celebratory, and all the more when the villagers brought out a concealed store of honey wine. Temeraire had even enjoyed a cupful poured into his mouth, so he might close his jaws on it and keep the crisp, fragrant smell on his tongue. Lawrence had not eaten very much, and now he came away from the village and the celebration back to Temeraire's side, but only to get out his maps again and study the roads. Temeraire drew a deep breath, watching him, and said valiantly,
"Lawrence, Lawrence, I have been thinking. Perhaps you might sell my talon sheaths. I do not mean just now," he added hurriedly, "but when the war is over."
"Why?"
Lawrence said, a good deal more absently than Temeraire felt such an offer merited.
"Are you tired of them?"
"No, of course not. Who could become tired of them?"
Temeraire said, and then paused. He was not sure how he might explain without betraying his knowledge of the loss which Lawrence had concealed, surely because it wounded him greatly.
"I only thought," he tried, "that perhaps you might like to have some more capital, as you have given me so much of it yourself."
"I have no need of capital," Lawrence said, "and you had better keep them against future need. I thank you for the offer. It was handsomely made," he added, which ought to have been a tremendous relief,
but Temeraire found that instead he was only unhappier for having tried his most desperate notion and found it of no use. Lawrence had not seemed even a little moved by the prospect of having so splendid a treasure for his own. The gratitude had been only formal. He put his head down upon his forelegs and watched Lawrence a little longer. Lawrence had a lamp, and in the light he looked a little odd. He was not quite clean-shaven, Temeraire realized, and there was some dried blood upon his jaw which he had not taken off. His hair was tied roughly back and grown long, but he did not seem to care for any of it. All his attention was for the map and the figures he was studying.
"May I not help you, Lawrence?" Temeraire asked at last,
rather hopelessly, for lack of any other idea. Lawrence paused over the papers, then put 1 sheet out with the lamp upon it.
"Is it large enough for you to see? It is the tax roll for the last year. I expect the French will first plunder the wealthier estates and villages, so we will look for them there.
Yes, I can read it, Temeraire said. It was only a little difficult if he squinted. Shall I tell you all the richest ones, in order?
As they pushed gradually southward, the raiding parties grew steadily larger and more desperate. No longer small bands out to forage for themselves as much as for the beasts, but urgent support for dragons headquartered now at small outposts and encampments throughout the heart of England to distribute the burden of their feeding. If the cattle did not arrive daily, the dragons would soon go hungry, and some number of them would have to be transferred elsewhere, southwards, even perhaps back to France. Already the disruption of the foraging was having an effect. Without the smaller parties bringing in regular provender, the soldiers had more effort to keep themselves fed as well as the dragons, and this made them all the more ruthless. Villages and farms and estates were now stripped to the bone, and often torn apart in the search for hidden stores, or even to no end but wanton destruction, some vicious urge in the soldiers brought on by too much license to ruin what they found. If any villagers sought to protect their homes and livelihoods, they were as often murdered or abused, or at best left to starve with a house burning behind them. These brutalities soon roused the countryside from a sullen, small resistance which would gladly have thrashed French soldiers making boastful remarks in a pub or passed news of them to British parties while concealing food from them all alike, to open hatred. No one fled from the dragons now when they landed, but marched out their cattle to feed them, and daily the plumes of beacon fires rose. The little feral dragons of the Pennines, who lived wild and ordinarily raided farms for their meals, had been recruited by hunger and Temeraire's persuasion to collect the far-flung intelligence. They darted from one beacon to another, where the townspeople provided them with a sheep or goat, and in return they carried the information back to Lawrence's encampment, daily edging farther south. Lawrence thought it likely he knew more of the movements of the French than their own generals did, and he daily sent long letters back to Jane and to Wellesley. A little blue feral came darting into camp an evening in Cumbria, while they sat mostly dull and quiet, sharpening bayonets or drinking watered whisky at their small fires, and in an incongruously deep voice announced,
"The French are coming this way, with guns and 12 dragons." "Leave the camp," Lawrence said, standing, and put back on his sword. "No, everything. We need the time more than the supply. Leave the fires burning. All aloft, gentlemen, at once," he said sharply, while everyone yet hesitated a moment and spurred them into action.
"But Lawrence," Temeraire murmured as he climbed aboard, "why do we not stay and fight them? It is our first chance of a real battle, and perhaps they will even have eagles."
"There is no honour to be won in a battle between thieves," Lawrence said flatly, taking the maps which Demaine held out to him and skimmed them over. "Divide into parties of no more than 3, and take separate routes, all of you. We rendezvous at Cross Fell," he called,
and they lifted one and all away. They were too agile a band to be easily tracked or caught, with 1,000 eyes in every direction looking out danger for them, and 3 more such attempts failed as thoroughly to find anything more than their abandoned fires and cooking pits. Rewards offered in vast sums were scornfully ignored, and in frustration the French grew savage, and turned instead to reprisals against any they suspected of providing intelligence or comfort, which made nearly all the citizenry. At Howick Hall, perhaps 2 weeks into their raiding, they caught a large company busy pillaging not only the cattle and the food, but carrying out also paintings and china plate and great silver candelabra, while the house burned slowly down around them, and their officers laughed and drank wine from the cellars in the courtyard. The dragon shadows falling over them silenced their merriment, and hurriedly 2 dozen muskets were raised up. Temeraire, hovering over them, roared out at the house, and nearly the whole front wall, flickering with flame, slid down in a heap and buried half the soldiers with it, leaving the building for a moment like a child's dollhouse opened for viewing, with more of the looters staring out at them. Then the roof, groaning in complaint, gave way, and the great house folded in upon itself, walls crumbling into brick, slates clattering and spilling down upon the lawn still smoking. The horses and cows stampeded madly away, and the remaining soldiers fled in the other direction, leaving a great pirate heap of goods in an ox-cart, pitiful, next to the smouldering ruins. The village, in the shelter of the house, had also been struck. The men, having tried to resist, had been slaughtered, nearly one and all. The women and children had taken shelter in the church, which had not given them much protection. The soldiers had come in, and outraged some of the young women, and murdered the vicar, a man of 80, when he had feebly tried to intercede.
"We ought to hunt down the rest of them," one young midshipman said. "Every last one!"
And there was no disagreement. Lawrence felt only weary.
"Berkeley," he said, "have your men clear the village and let the dragons bury the dead. Sutton, Little, take the other reapers and bring over what you can from the house. They will need more supply here. Or we can take you to Craster," he offered to the matron, who had got the survivors into some order.
"They won't have better houses for us there," she said. "Whatever you can bring us, we'll thank you for, Captain, and we will manage. They didn't find all there was to find."
She did not say aloud that they had now fewer mouths to feed. The yellow reapers were a while in returning and came back with an air of grim satisfaction, blood-stained, carrying also some dead cattle and deer.
"I will venture a little farther," Lawrence said. "We will not encamp yet, but we will raid farther south as far as we can fly in and out again in a day."
"Just as well," Little said, low. "Let them look over their shoulders, everywhere in England," to a murmur of agreement.
The French had thus reconciled them all to their mission. Few of the captains any more looked askance at their attacks or urged quarter. Lawrence heard it without satisfaction.
"I'm sure I can fly a little quicker if I try,"
Maximus put in. They held their conferences out in the air so the dragons might listen in. Some 4 days later, summoned by another column of smoke, they found and destroyed another raiding party at Woolerton. Flying back from the battlefield with the corpses left behind, dark and crimson on the snow, Lawrence saw one after another the blackened husks of houses he knew, familiar. Great houses were burning everywhere, ideal targets, their cellars full of wine and brandy, their pantries laden for winter. The Galman estate yet stood, but deserted, with a ragpicker's wares strewn all over the courtyard, curtains and carpets torn and trodden into mud, and more hanging out of the shattered windows. The stables were burnt to the ground, and the old lily pond, where he had used to walk with Edith, choked upon the bloated corpse of a horse, torn at the haunches where dogs had got to it. He knew he must expect to find Woolerton Hall itself burnt, and only hope his family had managed to flee in time. He was steeled for it, he thought. At least he could contemplate the possibility without a feeling of anything more than a calm and distant regret. Then they came over the lake, and Woolerton Hall stood upon the crest of its hill untouched, with light in the windows and neat thin trails of smoke only from the chimneys, gilt and golden and deer bounding away urgently. They landed in the park. The dragons went to hunt. Lawrence climbed a ridge and stood looking at the house with a sense almost of unreality. Twilight was deepening as he watched, and in the muted light the edges of the house blurred.
"Well, it is good luck," Harcourt said to him, uncertainly.
"You will pardon me," he said. "I will not be long."
And he walked across the lawn towards the house. The hedgerows were trimmed, and the walks had been swept of snow. There was a murmur of noise and life, louder as he came to the house, until standing in the formal gardens he might look in through the glass at the candle-lit ballroom full of people, standing and sitting and lying, on pallets and on camp beds, cottagers he recognised, others from the village.
"Here now, what are you about? You may come to the front if you're wanting something,"
someone said to Lawrence, making him start. A young gardener, scowling and holding a rake as though he would do something with it.
"I am William Lawrence," he said. "Is Lady Allendale here?"
She came out to him, wrapped in a cloak against the chill, wool only and not her furs.
"Will, my dear," she said, "are you well? Have you come alone?"
"We are encamped in the park to hunt only," Lawrence said. "We leave again as soon as the dragons are fed. Are you well? And my father?"
"As well as anyone could expect with all this upheaval," she said. "He knows a little of what has happened. He knows you are with the corps again," she added anxiously.
He said nothing. There was nothing to be proud of in the service he was giving.
"I'm glad to find you unmolested," he said after a moment, strangely reluctant. "We came over the village. I hope Lord and Lady Galman are well."
Lady Allendale, too, hesitated.
"Yes, they stay with us."
He paused again and, reaching into his coat, brought out the ring, in the small envelope of paper he had folded around it.
"I wish that I had not. I'm sorry to bear ill tidings," he said. "Mr. Woolvey was killed, in London. I have kept it to send to Edith, when that might be possible. If her parents might—"
"Yes, we had word,"
she said, low and unhappy, and took it from him. She curled her hand around the envelope, and her face looked drawn.
"He died well," Lawrence said, "if that can be said. He died, bravely at least, in service to the Crown."
She nodded, and they stood silently. A little snow yet was falling, white flecks upon her dark cloak.
"Tell me,"
he said finally.
"An officer came, and gave us the Emperor's compliments, and assurances that we would never be harmed," she said. "None of the raiding parties have come here, even lately when they are pillaging everywhere."
"Yes," Lawrence said, stopping her, "I understand."
And understood also his own dread. Of course. Bonaparte had managed to pay him for his treason after all.
"We can shelter a great many more," she said quietly after a moment. "Our stores also are untouched. If there are any you would like to send to us—"
"If you can send a cart to Woolerton," he said. "They were struck this morning and have wounded."
"Yes, of course," she said. "Can you not stay the night?"
With an effort he kept himself from recoiling, and only touched his hat.
"I must beg your pardon. We have some hours yet to fly tonight," he said,
and bowed and turned. The lights of the house glittered on the snow as he walked away.